May it please the Court, Timothy Berg of Fenimore Craig on behalf of Appellant Jason Halpern. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves a party who, after agreeing to enter into a joint venture under terms set forth in a side agreement, does everything he can to sabotage the potential joint venture by proposing terms that are inconsistent with the side agreement and by refusing to negotiate in good faith the terms of that joint venture. The issue before the Court today more narrowly is whether the District Court properly granted summary judgment on Mr. Halpern's anticipatory repudiation claim, given that there were genuine issues of material fact concerning the terms of the side agreement between Mr. Halpern and Mr. Tharaldson and what they meant, and at least genuine issues of material fact, and I would contend there really aren't any, and they go our way, but let's say genuine issues of material fact as to whether Mr. Tharaldson and his agents repudiated the agreement by their conduct.
Let's assume that there is a repudiation here of the part of the agreement that says if you exercise the option, I'll enter into a joint venture. What do we do with the fact that the option wasn't exercised?
I think, Your Honor, under the law of New York, once Mr. Tharaldson made it clear he wasn't going to negotiate in good faith and he wasn't going to perform his part of the bargain, Mr. Halpern was excused from tendering the $5 million.
In order to agree with you, do we have to conclude that the terms that Mr. Tharaldson, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, proposed were not commercially reasonable?
No, I think if you conclude...
Isn't that the language that was used?
Your Honor, first, if you conclude they were inconsistent with the terms the parties had already agreed to in the side agreement, that would be a repudiation in and of itself. Secondly, if you were to conclude they weren't inconsistent with specific terms, but they were commercially unreasonable, that would be a repudiation. I think it's a repudiation either way. If I sign a letter with Judge Hurwitz saying we're going to do this, this, and this, he can repudiate that, and then we're going to negotiate some other commercially reasonable terms. He can repudiate that contract either by rejecting the terms we've already agreed to and indicating he isn't going to perform them, or by insisting on commercially unreasonable terms for the rest of our
agreement. Am I correct that the dispute here is whether the 50-50 split of the proceeds from the sale of the property would we be net of contributions or gross?
More specifically, the question is, would it be net of contributions to a previous partnership that wasn't involved in this transaction, which is what Mr. Tharaldson wanted to do, or whether it would be based on the contributions they'd made to this particular joint venture, the LVNG joint venture, in which each of them had put $5 million. And it's $5 million plus a little bit in costs, but everybody sort of used the term $5 million, including the district judge. So it's slightly different. The question is, does the pari passu equal contribution, equal distribution provision say, we've each put $5 million into this deal, and therefore we're going to split everything equally? Or does it allow Mr. Tharaldson to say, I want to be paid for all these monies I put into this prior investment partnership that isn't the partnership Mr. Halpern is now buying into?
So let's assume for a second that the proposed waterfall, if you will, is inconsistent with the pari passu concept. Is the side agreement, as you call it, you know, not the option, but what will happen if the option is exercised, sufficiently certain to enforce? I mean, it says, and let me focus on the part of it that troubles me. It says, well, we'll share equally in decisions, and we'll share in profits and, I guess, losses, pari passu. And it says, and then we'll also have a buyout in case we can't agree. On what terms? Who gets to exercise it? Who gets paid? It strikes me that's a pretty vague provision.
It seems to me you've got four definite provisions. One, you've got what Mr. Halpern has to pay to get into it.
Right.
$8,000.
The $5 million. You've got what the decision-making process is. All decisions will be made by agreement with Mr. Tharaldson and Mr. Halpern. The third provision, the buyout provision, I think, Your Honor, says if when we try to govern this thing by equal decision-making, if we come to the point where we simply can't operate because two people each having 50% of the vote, we just loggerheads, then we'll buy each one of us will buy the other out.
Who?
I think it gave either side the option to buy the other out at that point.
At what price?
Presumably, it isn't clear, but I think implicit in it was at the money that was put into the deal, at least, plus any additional monies the parties had expended.
Not at the current value of the property?
Your Honor, I guess it isn't completely clear on
that. And I guess my question is, because it isn't clear, do we have an agreement here that's sufficiently certain to enforce?
I think you do, Your Honor, because the part of it we're asking you to enforce is clear. That's the pari passu provision, which says if we sell this property, Mr. Halpern gets half of the proceeds. And that's clear, and if it isn't clear, if it's ambiguous, there's contradictory testimony on that point between Mr. Friedman and Mr. Keep, and that had to go to a jury. The trial court couldn't decide that on a motion for summary judgment. I would suggest, Your Honor, the court asked us to talk about the Adjust Right case, and I would suggest to you the other way of looking at this is to look at Adjust Right. Adjust Right says there are three kinds of agreements that you say you're going to document later. One is you negotiate all of the terms, and then you're just going to put it into a document. And our position would be this is pretty close to that, if not there. But secondarily, and maybe more importantly, it says the parties can agree to certain terms, leave certain terms open to be negotiated later. And the other party, a party breaches that kind of agreement by refusing to negotiate in good faith or by doing something inconsistent with the explicit terms that have already been agreed to.
What's the remedy when somebody refuses to negotiate in good faith over an unclear term? What does the court order?
Well, I think here again, Your Honor, we're not dealing with an unclear term. If we're here fighting about the buyout, then maybe that would be relevant. But my position would be the provision we're fighting about here is clear, and Mr. Theraldson, by insisting that that waterfall be in the agreement and telling Mr. Halpern he wasn't going to negotiate with him and he had only one option, and Mr. Cape telling them not to bother and he was going to make their life miserable, he repudiated that express provision, and that's enough to go to a jury and let a jury decide if it thinks that the provision means what we said it meant and whether Mr. Theraldson in fact repudiated it.
Now talking about your third cause of action? Your third cause of action seems to be Mr. Theraldson failed to act in good faith. And so is that where we are? Are we talking about your third cause of action?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think what we're talking about here is anticipatory repudiation. We pled three claims: breach of contract, breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and anticipatory repudiation. And what I would suggest to you is that if we enter into an option contract, you and I, and you then do something that takes away the benefit of my exercising the option for me, you've anticipatorily repudiated the deal.
The problem here, which makes it a little bit more complicated, is you're not really alleging an anticipatory repudiation of the option contract. What you're alleging is that an anticipatory repudiation of the joint venture contract that would follow the exercise of the option. Nothing here prevented you from exercising the option.
Your Honor, we cite cases in both our opening and reply brief that say that's not the correct analysis. For example, there was a case where someone had a right to enter into a lease, and one of the conditions of that lease was that they go get a liquor license. The other side didn't prevent them from getting a liquor license, but it said, we're not going to lease you the property anymore. What Mr. Theraldson did here is exactly the same thing. He didn't prevent Mr. Halpern from tendering $5 million. There's no dispute about that. What he did was say that you can give me $5 million, but I'm not going to fulfill the side agreement we have because I'm not going to enter into
a joint venture. It's a side agreement that we ought to be focusing on, not whether or not there was an anticipatory repudiation of the option.
No, it's whether there's an anticipatory repudiation of the side agreement. I agree with that, Your Honor. That's correct. If I said something else, I misspoke.
And do you characterize the side agreement as the great Judge LaValle would call the binding preliminary commitment?
I think it's at least that, Your Honor. I think there's an argument to be made that it's more than that it falls into the first category. But I think it's at the very least a binding preliminary commitment to enter into a joint venture agreement containing the terms that are already in the side agreement and other terms. And what Mr. Therelson had an obligation to do was comply with the terms he'd already agreed to and negotiate in good faith, and he did neither.
And when the failure to negotiate in good faith was the presentation of the waterfall and then saying take it or leave it.
Yeah, waterfall, and not just take it or leave it, but Mr. Cape saying we're going to make your life miserable if you keep negotiating, I won't negotiate anymore, Mr. Therelson saying take it or leave it, Mr. Therelson admitting he really didn't give Mr. Halperin any options. I don't actually think there's a genuine issue of material fact about whether Mr. Therelson repudiated this agreement. I think there's really no evidence going the other way. But if there were, even if a counsel can come up here and tell you these are all the things Mr. Therelson did that are inconsistent with a repudiation, at the very least, we've presented enough evidence to go to a jury on this claim.
Can we go back, and I know you want to save some time, go back to what the district judge found, and I guess here's my question. Do you have an obligation to put him to the test under these circumstances? Does Mr. Halperin have to say, look, your position is crazy. I'm exercising the option, and if you don't agree to an agreement that's 50-50, I'm going to sue you? Or does he? Can he say, now you've indicated you're going to be, you may take a difficult position if I do exercise the option, so I'm not going to exercise it?
I think, Your Honor, under the cases we've cited in both our opening brief and our reply brief, when somebody indicates they're not going to follow through on their side of the agreement, you don't have to tender performance.
Now, none of those really deal with this sort of strange condition precedent circumstance.
Well, they do in a way, Your Honor. Again, look at the case I was talking about the lease, where I had had an obligation to go get a liquor license. There was a case, and we cited in our brief, and I don't recall the name off the top of my head, and I apologize for that, where someone had a stock option, and he had to exercise the option in order to get the stock. And and actually make a payment. I think it was $200,000 in the facts of that case. And the company he had the stock option in canceled the stock option, said, we're not going to give you that stock.
I take your point, but those cases, and the reason I find them a little difficult, is they involve a party to the option anticipatorily repudiating. You know, you exercise the option, doesn't matter. I won't let you do, I won't give you the thing that you bargained for.
And that's exactly what happened here. What Mr. Cape and Mr. Therelson said to Mr. Halperin and Mr. Friedman was, we don't care if you give us the $5 million or not. We're not going to enter into the deal that the side agreement says we're supposed to enter into. We're not going to negotiate commercially reasonable terms.
Is that what he said?
I think that's exactly what he said. Well, not in those words. What he said is, I'm going to make you agree to terms that are inconsistent with the deal we already have, and if you won't agree to those, we don't have a deal. I won't go any further. He didn't refuse to perform on the grounds that there wasn't a payment, Your Honor. He refused to perform on the grounds that he didn't like the deal that Mr. Cape had struck with Mr. Halperin and Mr. Friedman.
Would there have even been a project if Therelson had not paid $10 million to release the personal guarantees on them both?
It is clear, Your Honor, that that someone had to buy the loan. Mr. Therelson did that. Mr. Halperin had a right to buy half of that note for $5 million under commercially reasonable terms with pari passu equal distributions. Mr. Therelson repudiated that obligation, and Mr. Halperin didn't have to do anything more. He was entitled to sue for anticipatory repudiation, either under the cases we suggested to you or under the AdjustRight case. I'd like to save my last minute and a half for a rebuttal if I can.
You have it. Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Gomez.
May it please the Court, Christina Gomez arguing on behalf of Gary Therelson. This case presents three issues of contract law, but let me first say what it's not about.
Of New York contract law.
Of New York contract law, correct.
Right. Well, that's why we're all struggling.
That's why you're referring us to Second Circuit law.
We brought a New York guy with us.
So let me tell you what it's not about. It's not about an agreement to agree on the terms of a possible joint venture, and it's not about an option agreement that was rescinded before it could be exercised. The side letter agreement allowed Halperin to purchase a 50% interest in LVNG, the entity that owned the senior loan, for a specific price, if and only if he exercised that option and bought his 50% interest in the entity, would the parties then be joint ventures and need to agree on the terms of their joint venture.
So these two contracts. These two agreements are just completely separate.
They,
I mean, you already know
it's
at least
part.
Some of the important provisions for the second agreement, mm-hmm. which is you put in an equal amount, you get out an equal amount. That's a and you have equal voting. Those are pretty important provisions, aren't they?
Well, I guess there's a few questions within that. I mean, the first is they are two parts. It's in stages. It's you, the language of it, you shall have a right to acquire up to a 50% interest in the loan provided that you do X, Y, and Z. It didn't say provided that you pay in, you give us written notice, and we agree on all the terms of the joint venture agreement. It says if you pay in, then you're 50% owner. Whether we agree on the terms of a joint venture agreement or not, he would have owned half of that entity, and maybe which is an LLC. They fall under just generic New York LLC law if they can't agree on the terms of a joint venture. That happens all the time.
So what you're saying is that what Mr. Halpern should have done was exercise the option, become a 50% owner, and say to Mr. Tharaldson, to hell with your waterfall.
Right.
It's not. Right. It's not part of the joint. It's not part of the joint venture.
This is exactly
now a 50% partner in a joint venture under New York law. I have 50%. I can make 50% of the decisions, and under New York law, I get 50% of the profits and losses. And your obstinance in not signing an agreement will make no difference. Is that your position?
Yes, and this is exactly what his agent Friedman told him to do in May of 2015. He said, we are perfectly within our rights to, quote, exercise the option and send a document to them that we would be willing to sign. That was page 412 of the excerpts of record. He said, this is what we can do. Two can play this game. He can negotiate what terms he wants. Well, let's exercise the option, and then we can negotiate the terms that we want. But he first needed to buy in, and once he bought in, they're partners. They've got to reach some kind of agreement.
Well, they don't have to. And see, that's what Mr. Berg says. Look, I wouldn't really – my client really didn't want to risk that. He didn't want to just be in a partnership with somebody who didn't agree with him on anything. We had a preliminary agreement, and that agreement said not only will we enter into this partnership, but we'll share equally in decision-making, and we'll share equally pari passu in the cash flow and profits, and we will – and your client said, no, I'm not willing to do that. And so why doesn't he say at that point, look, I'm not going to buy into a fight. I had a deal.
He could have just walked away if he thought, well, this isn't going to work. But what he should have done is bought in and then sort things out. But I'm going to answer the other piece of that, and it gets to the other piece of the question you were asking a moment ago. It's just the assumption that these terms, the pari passu, meant only specifically for this piece of this larger puzzle.
At least on the face of it, that's what it seems to mean. You say it means something different, but isn't there at least a fact question about what it means?
What it basically means, well, if you're asking is there an ambiguity in that, do you have to figure that out? It just means if the parties didn't make clear in that, then that's you can't anticipatorily breach it. If the terms that Mr. Tharaldson and his agents were offering were not very clearly inconsistent, then it's not an anticipatory repudiation. Those are terms that hadn't been totally clarified up front. And I'll also point
out, aren't they clear on their face? What you seem to be saying is that even though anybody reading this would say we're going to share 50-50 in the joint venture, there was a side understanding that your client could recover something
first. No, not a side understanding. And I'll point the court to the language in the little letter I. All decisions and governance with respect to the loan purchaser, the loan, the property, the budget, and the business plans, and all things in connection therewith will require. I mean, basically, that's not the obviously the pari passu comes in the little letter the triple I, but it's an indication in there, we're not dealing just with this loan. We're looking at the property as a whole. And these two parties, both were earlier investors in this property. The only reason that Tharaldson bought the loan to begin with was because of the $30 million guarantee that he was getting out of it. I don't know why you would make an assumption that then this new piece of the deal is going to completely ignore everything that came before it. That all of a sudden now, when he's over $7 million in and Halpern is $250,000 in, that he's going to agree that all of a sudden now everything he's put in before is wiped out and doesn't matter.
But why isn't that a question of – it's a great argument, and it might be the right way to interpret this. But why isn't that a question of fact for a jury?
Because we're looking at this in terms of an anticipatory repudiation and a preliminary agreement that didn't have all of the terms perfectly nailed down.
But what if a jury were to find that that wasn't the understanding of the parties, that your client would be able to recover his previous investments? Then wouldn't this be an anticipatory repudiation?
Only if the contract, if this were a contract that had completely spelled out and had mentioned that all of our earlier investments in this property are irrelevant, we are going to foreclose on this loan, this is exactly how it's going to be. These were pretty vague terms. That was like, we're going to sit down later once you've bought in, and we're going to sort out all of these pieces.
So your position, as I understand it, is that this case is no more complex than this. The two parties were together on this property earlier on. The recession came along. The loan was foreclosed upon, or they weren't able to pay on it. And your client came up with $10 million to buy the loan, the effect of which was to release both sides from the personal guarantee.
That's right.
And your client is saying, your price of participating in the new project is to come up with $5 million to make us even. Because I came up with $10 million to get us both off the hook.
Well,
is the case more complex than that?
It sounds like you're not acknowledging the fact that it wasn't, this $10 million wasn't the first money they had invested in the property. He's already in over $7 million.
But if your client hadn't come up with the $10 million, they would still be on the hook for the guarantees, correct?
That's true, which were $30 million guarantees. They both would, right, right. And the indication in the record was...
But your client's position was the price of participating is to come up with, if you will, your half of the $10
million. Right.
That I put in to save us both.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
I mean, There's nothing wrong with that, with saying he's got to pay his $5 million if he wants in on this part of the deal. And the waterfall was saying, we're no longer looking at what we were before, where we're paying.
Go back to your original point, though, because now you've got me interested in this. Let's assume that Mr. Halpern exercises the option, pays in $5 million, and becomes a 50-50 partner in whatever the LLC is called. Can your client then demand that he be reimbursed for his previous investments?
It's open at that point in time. They're
No, it's not. Let's assume we just have 50-50 partners who own this loan, because that's really what they own.
They own a loan that's secured by
the property.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and they each own a loan 50-50, and it's secured by the property. Does your client then have the ability to demand from Mr. Halpern that he reimburse him for prior investments?
He can say, we're not going to foreclose on this loan. They certainly, as venturers who both own, they're both part of earlier investments and the later thing. They can say we're not going to treat this as a $30 million investment.
It's a partnership of joint venture
that
in which each party owns 50%. And whose assets are really a property secured by the loan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, securing the loan. At that point, that's all there is, isn't there? You don't get to bring in
maybe.
Prior.
I mean, maybe. We're not in that situation.
Absent
unfortunately.
Another agreement, though, you don't get to bring in prior history or do anything else. So what you're saying is really that Mr. Halpern agreed to take less than a 50% ownership in
this
joint venture.
You can't just take out the fact that these were not third parties who had no previous involvement in this I mean, you can't just pretend like that piece of it doesn't exist, that they haven't been in this venture together for this period of time and say, well, all of a sudden now our client is this far in and all of a sudden he's going to say, sure, I'm going to give you an equal share of everything, notwithstanding that I've been carrying most of the bill at this point in time.
Let me ask the question differently. Before the date when let's assume that the option, there's a date to exercise the option just to make it easier. Up until the exercise of the option, does Mr. Halpern have any interest whatsoever in this property or loan?
In this loan? No.
No.
He had none.
Okay.
And he, right, of course, so, we're here now because he had the option
since he has no interest, what is all this prior history? Why does all this prior history matter if he exercises his option to buy half the loan?
It matters because that was the only reason why he was being offered a piece of, like, the 50% interest in this sort of new stage of the venture that they already had been in. I'm not sure how else to answer that.
Yeah, my questions sort of flow from your opening where you said, look, if he wasn't happy, he should have exercised the option, and we would have had a joint venture in which he had 50%.
Right.
And the answer is he would have had 50% of a joint venture.
Right.
At that point, I'm not sure your client gets to say, hey, I know we have 50% of a joint venture, but I got a history. Would you give me $7 million first before we do
it? Well, at that point, they never got to that point. They never got to negotiating it.
Exactly. We don't know that, right?
Exactly. And I'm going to use that maybe as a segue to answer one of the questions that you asked earlier was, what's the remedy if you're in the good faith and fair dealing context? And also whether we're here on the third claim, which, of course, was dismissed and wasn't appealed. And part of the reason it was dismissed was because it was overlapping with the claims that were there. What they never did was say, all right, we're suing for a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing because we had an agreement here that was an agreement to agree, and we needed to work out all the open terms, and we never got to that point. The remedy for that under New York law and Second Circuit law is your out-of-pocket costs. It's not what the deal would have been, because the problem is the court can't know exactly what the deal would have been.
That's
like
the
buy-in, buy-out question. Exactly right. We don't know what amount it was, and if it was, as my colleague answers here, well, maybe you could have gotten your $5 million in change back. Well, that's the position we're in. They never put that money in, so there's nothing to get back out. They've never alleged any out-of-pocket costs here.
But nonetheless, if this turned out to be a contract to bargain in good faith, wouldn't it be a question for the jury as to whether or not there had, in fact, been good faith bargaining?
What I'm saying is, and I guess the short answer would be, for all the reasons that we talked about before, it wouldn't be, because the only way you get to a breach of that is if, A, you're insisting on terms, and B, those are clearly inconsistent with terms that have already been nailed down in the contract.
I don't think we're there. The shorter answer, the question Judge Eaton's asking you, and I'm interested in your answer, is even assuming that were all the case, mm-hmm. what you're saying is that all you get for the failure to negotiate in good faith are your out-of-pocket costs. You don't get the agreement.
Right. And then
what case do you cite for that?
This we didn't cite in our briefs because we weren't going down this road, but there's a case, L7 Designs. It's a Second Circuit case, 647 F3rd 419. If the court wants us to do any further briefing on this, I'm sure we could do that.
Well, you can submit a supplemental citation.
Okay.
But maybe you could answer my question. Why would it not be a question for the jury whether or not the negotiations were carried out in good faith?
I think because under the IDT case, it has to be clearly inconsistent with the terms that are already nailed down, and I think we're not there. But I'm going to say, even aside from that, because there's no damages that are alleged with any kind of certainty, you can't get there. I mean, first of all, there's no out-of-pocket costs that were ever alleged. They didn't pay those in. But secondarily, for all the reasons that we've already said in our briefing, I don't think you have to get to the hard contract issues. You can just say their damages are so speculative. And if I could just say one thing
nonetheless, why wouldn't it be a question for the jury?
Most of the cases, if not all of the cases that we cited on that piece, on the damages question, were cases where New York courts had decided that issue as a matter of law, when there's no expert testimony, all you've got is the individual themselves just speculating, hey, I think we could have gotten there and I would have made this money.
Why wouldn't it have been a question?
Oh, you're talking about on the first part, on the first piece of it?
Yeah, why wouldn't it be, whether or not you negotiated in good faith, why isn't that a question for the jury?
That's the, I go back to, the only thing I can go back to is the IDT case, which is the New York case that says.
That there aren't any damages?
If, no, that was, I'm sorry, that was not a damages case. That was, that's the case on the first issue, which is if you're not demanding things that are inconsistent with the contract, then that's not, there's no breach there.
But how would you know if you didn't, if there wasn't evidence and evidence taken in the jury trial?
Well, I will submit that on the summary judgment record. You can't get there. But even if you had concerns about that, you can still affirm because the damages are speculative, and we have several cases we've cited on that basis.
Thank you. Mr. Berg, why don't we put 2 minutes on the clock since we took Ms. Gomez a little bit over time?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with the damages questions, and there's 2 points I want to make. The first is, and we also didn't cite any of these cases, because the AdjustRight case wasn't before us. But if you read the AdjustRight case, I believe you will find there are cases that say in breach of certain kinds of contracts under that second category, the agreement to agree on certain terms and then go on in the future, you can recover lost profits, not just out-of-pocket costs, and we'll submit a supplemental citation on that. The question of are the damages too speculative? There is enough evidence here to go to the jury. You have two things. You have Mr. Therelson's own waterfall showing that he estimated that the property would sell for with water rights for $33 million, and then he went around and deducted out of that. That's sufficient evidence to survive a motion for summary judgment. Second, you have the testimony from Mr. Friedman and Mr. Halperin that D.R. Horton was willing to buy the property for $24 million net of the water rights and perhaps a higher amount depending on how many lots could be built. Again, the jury can choose to believe that or they cannot to, but it's enough to get us by a motion for summary judgment.
On your damages point, I was interested in this. It seems to me that the argument that if the waterfall's right, mm-hmm. which is part of your damages argument, or if at least the Horton deal is solid.
I think we'd say the top line of the waterfall
okay.
is right.
Or that it's solid. And your client put in his $5 million and the other side took out the $7 million first, how much would you have made?
If you look at Mr. Therelson's waterfall and take it as gospel,
yeah.
each side makes a couple $100,000. And I don't think anybody would have put themselves to this kind of deal and this kind of expense to ultimately get a couple $100,000 down the line. That's part of what makes Mr. Therelson's waterfall commercially unreasonable, as well as inconsistent with the side letter agreement, which is the more important point, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank both sides for their excellent briefs and arguments, and this case will be submitted.
Recess?
We're going to take a 10-minute recess, and then we'll hear the last case on the calendar.